kids. Bat Segundo here, and I'm once again caught in an undignified position, swallowing my pride and introducing these dreadful little segments, so I'll keep it short and sweet. It turns out that Edward Champion is not our young roving correspondent at all, but an amalgamation of the podcaster's dark side, somewhere between his 12th and final regeneration. We've set up a trial for this podcaster, and it should go on for 14 different shows, which will make no sense at all. But in the meantime, please enjoy Rupert Thompson and Edward Falco.
19 lip bloggers, one finalist, 5 nominees, one, finalist, 5 authors, 1 podcaster, 5 Mondays, 5 interviews, 1 podcasts. Anyway, the hell with it. It's the LBC Podcast!
Reading time is a factor in this, so please pay attention. Answer as quickly as you can. You're in a library, walking among the books, when all of a sudden you look down and see a...
What one?
What?
What library?
It doesn't make any difference what library. It's completely hypothetical.
But how come I'd be there?
Maybe you're read up. Maybe you want a new literary diversion, an overlooked title. Who knows? So you look down, and you see a dystopian work of fiction. It's depressing as hell, and...
Dystopian fiction? What's that? Ever read 1984?
Of course.
Same thing. I never picked up a dystopian work of fiction, but I understand what you mean.
You reach down, and you see that the book is Divided Kingdom by Rupert Thompson. But you're not reading.
What you mean I'm not reading?
I mean you're not reading. Why is that, Leon? They're just questions, Leon. It's a test. Designed to provoke a post-structuralist response. Shall we continue? Describe, in declarative sentences, only the good books you'd recommend to Dr. Joyce Brothers.
Dr. Joyce Brothers?
Yeah.
Let me tell you about Dr. Joyce Brothers.
So, I have here Megan of Book Dwarf, who is the...
Hello,
how you doing? Who nominated Rupert Thompson's Divided Kingdom. Now, Megan, I was wondering if you could tell us exactly what it was about Divided Kingdom that sort of struck your fancy that made it, this is the LBC nominee.
I guess it was the premise of the novel that sort of got my attention in the beginning. It seemed so hokey at first, and I didn't think that I'd actually enjoy the book. And then about 50 pages in, it grabbed me, and I couldn't stop reading it until I finished it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably one of the best books I've read in the past year, so...
What was it about it that grabbed you?
The premise is, you know, dividing the England into the 4 humors, and you know, putting the various people, assigning them to a category, which sounds kind of dumb at first, but the way he writes it, he's very character-driven,
mm-hmm.
Rupert Thompson, and he builds the scene very well, and then describes things very well, and I just love the whole story, so...
Now, had you read any Rupert Thompson before this, or...?
No, in fact, I think it was Maude Newton who had first mentioned this book on her website,
mm-hmm.
and she sort of started raving about Thompson and how excited she was with the new book, and I just so happened to get a hold of a galley that same day from the Random House rep.
Oh, cool.
A friend of mine, so...
Gotcha. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Megan.
No problem.
Okay.
Hi-ho, it's home from Earth we go.
So, I am here with Rupert Thompson, LBC nominee for his novel, Divided Kingdom. How are you doing, Rupert?
I'm very well, thank you, Ed.
So, I wanted to first of all kind of get a sense of where did this idea come from? It struck me as a very, having a country divided by 4 humors struck me as a very unusual concept, and yet you somehow managed to make it work quite well and managed to convince me. I was wondering what steps you made to actually get this to happen as a writer.
Many, many steps is the answer. I mean, when I what tends to happen with me is that my ideas, when they first occur to me, aren't really ideas. They're not even so much as germs. They're some fragment that I find myself for some reason interested in. And in this case, all I really had at the beginning was the idea, or rather the memory of this one girl, actually. It was a girlfriend of a friend of mine back in the early 80s in London, and she was Swedish, but she was unusual because every time you saw her, she was always smiling, always in a good mood. I mean, so much so that it began to irritate, you know, the rest of us. And we thought, how can anyone be so unremittingly cheerful. And simply that idea of I started thinking, well, how common is that? I mean, how many people like that are there, you know, who are just naturally cheerful all the time? And that was the beginning. It sounds really inauspicious, I know, and no one else could probably have turned it into a novel. But that's where it started. And then the next step would have been really a year later, bumping into a professor of medieval history at a party in London again. And he started talking about the humours for some reason. And I suddenly put that together with, I put the idea of a sanguine personality together with the memory of that Swedish girl, and I suddenly thought, well, okay, there's not just one type. What if there were four types? What if a country was divided up in that way? And even then, it was, and this tends to happen with most of my ideas, it seemed totally implausible, and yet it seemed to throw down a gauntlet. You know, it seemed to be saying, see what you can make of this.
Well, the impressive thing about this novel is I looked at the back of the book and saw all of these very copious books that you had used for research. To synthesize all that into what I felt was very sparkling prose. I mean, I'm wondering what level of craftsmanship or how many drafts did it take to sort of get it down to a point where the story just moved and sparkled on the page?
No, that's a good question because... there was a lot of research, oddly, for this book, despite it really being a work of the imagination almost entirely. It was just that at certain points, I found myself, you know, I would be writing about one particular kind of society, say a benevolent dictatorship, which I thought the sanguine part of the novel is like, and I would suddenly think about Singapore and Lee Kuan Yew, and I'd think, wait a minute, how did that work? And I'd read a book about Lee Kuan Yew, running Singapore in the 60s, 70s, and I'd realize there were things in common there, and also tiny things I could draw on. At the same time, the danger is, I think, if you're writing a book like this, is you know, the research can overwhelm you, and I think I've always had this theory that you have to balance the imagined facts against real facts, and for me, imagined facts are much, much more important. So generally, I try and write a first draft without doing any research at all, and the first or second draft will then throw up kind of research I need to do, and that gets absorbed into third, fourth draft. And my books tend to go through as many as 10, 11, 12 complete drafts probably. And when I say, you know, that not only means going from the beginning to the end, it also means that I'm going back within that draft. So, and just to give you an idea of what that might mean with Divided Kingdom, because at one point Divided Kingdom was close to 900 pages long.
Wow.
Something like, it was well over a quarter of a million words, and it was getting out of control. And that draft took 5 months of working 7 days a week. You know, it almost killed me.
Oh,
but, I mean, it had to be done, because it was one of those books that had to be written long before it could be written short. You know, I had to imagine everything and then remove what I'd imagined. Otherwise I'd be cheating the reader. I felt, you know, I had to really know how each of these four countries worked, how it would have been at the beginning, how it would have been 25 years later, and so all that had to be imagined. But then once I'd imagined it, you realised, God, this is not so much a novel as a textbook, you know. So I had to just then start taking it back down and trying to work out what exactly it should be about.
Well, it's interesting that is your process, because the actual text itself reminded me very much of the way that you read an Ian McEwan novel and the sentences just literally snap out at you because they are so precise, because McEwan is just absolutely ruthless about the way that he sort of, you know, compresses his text.
Well, I mean, this is the bit where craft takes over from inspiration. You know, I mean, to me, that people always people talk a lot about inspiration, and you know, for instance, when I came to Barcelona, they said, "Oh, have you gone there for inspiration?" And I don't need to go anywhere for inspiration for a start. And the second point is that inspiration is really kind of the start of it, and I suppose it's the fire of it and everything. It's where a book begins, but almost all. Most of writing is really about craft and about the kind of applying of really ruthless technique to what you've imagined, you know. And I mean, I'm getting better at that. I mean, I think if you look at my, if you ever look at my first book, you'll see Dreams of Leaving, it was called, and it had a kind of wonderful sort of spirit on the page because it was completely free, and it was like you could tell that it was someone writing for the first time, and everything was in there, you know. But it had a lovely anarchy about it, but it didn't have such a great discipline. And I can forgive myself for that, I suppose. But I think as you go on, you start to be, I think you just get harder and harder on yourself, and there is that sort of delicious moment where you actually remove a whole page or that's actually beautifully written but doesn't need to be there. And I think when you find yourself doing things like that, you know you're beginning to learn something about, you know, what writing is.
At the same time, the interesting thing about this book is that there are like little goofball moments of humor, such as the surfing thing, which I found really amusing myself.
they shouldn't sort of stick out as I didn't intend them to be vignettes exactly. You know, I wanted it all to be part of the same thing, and yeah, they're kind of they're pretty surreal, and there are surreal elements to all of the four parts of the Divided Kingdom. You know, they all have their moments, as it were.
Well, you
and they sort of need their moments. Yeah, and I love the idea of, as soon as I thought of subterranean surfing, I had to write that scene.
There was one motif in this book that I noticed quite a lot, and there was a lot of curlicue imagery. You have the salamander, you have the question mark here. I was wondering if what was the conscious move to put that in there? Was
Oh no, that's the kind of thing you as a clever reader would pick up, and I probably would have just done subconsciously. I mean, obviously there are some things you do intentionally, but I mean, it reminds me of the story about Gabriel Garcia Marquez, you know, because I think his one of his children went off to school and they were actually reading one of his short stories that day in school, and the teacher said, you know, there's this cockerel in the story, and what do you think the writer intends this to mean? What's it supposed to symbolize? And people had all kinds of the children had all kinds of ideas about what this cockerel was supposed to symbolize, and the son or the daughter went home to her father, the writer, and said, this cockerel in your story, Dad, you know, what's it mean? And Gabriel Garcia Marquez said, just a cockerel. It's just a cockerel, you know. There are things that you put in because there are things that you put in without knowing that you're putting them in, and an intuition, I think, is a huge part of what a novelist has to have in their armory, if you like. I mean, I think you have to completely rely on your intuition. You have to trust it. It has to be your friend. And if it isn't, then I think you're probably in trouble.
Do you feel that, well, particularly here in the States, I think it's more present than it is perhaps in Europe, but being pigeonholed as a speculative fiction author, and whether that gets in the way of people sort of, you know, enjoying Divided Kingdom and many of the ideas and the descriptions and the prose that's there, does that, you know, is that something that you think about? Is that something that you think you were fighting to sort of escape, or...?
It is something I think about. I mean, I'm not sure what I can do about it exactly, because in fact, I think it's partly because I've always eluded pigeonholes. I mean, I sort of think probably what I write is, there's this wonderful word, genre-defying, you know, and it's sort of, I use lots of genres in my writing, and often two or three or four in a single book, and yet it doesn't seem to be any one of those things. You know, you couldn't say Divided Kingdom is science fiction, you couldn't say it's a satire, you couldn't say it's a love story, and yet it's got elements of all those genres in it. And I think critics, when I've read them, especially in England, have always tried to kind of put what I do in one pigeonhole or another. You know, for a while I was a thriller writer, and for a while I was a cult writer, and you know, I've been lots of things, actually. And maybe I'm now a writer of speculative fiction, but I mean, it won't necessarily last, because the next book, which is almost finished, is very precisely set, not only geographically, but in time. And so there's nothing speculative about it in that sense at all. So, you know, I mean, I'm quite happy to go on sort of wrong footing the people who are trying to pigeonhole me.
Well, this book is really, really tightly plotted. It's very much a sort of quest tale, but at the same time, it's a little bit more than that, because we talked about the ideas. I'm wondering, to what extent do you design or write a novel to be entertaining, and to what extent would it be literary for you?
Well, I mean, ideally, of course, it should be both. I mean, I think the point about entertaining the reader is an important one, because I think you have to do that. I mean, I oddly enough, I'm lucky in that way. I mean, I seem to write books, even though I don't have massive sales. I mean, it seems that anyone who does read any of my books can't put it down. I mean, this is what I get told a lot. You know, they read the books pretty fast, and they get locked into them, and they can't put it down until they've really got to the end of it, and then they carry on thinking about it. And that's fine by me. And in fact, a lot of the time, what I'm trying to do these days is working against that and trying to slow the reader down. You know, because I've now got this awareness of having some kind of natural page turning quality to what I do, and sometimes I think if what you write have too much of that, then the readers are going to miss a lot of what's in it, because most readers, after all, don't read a novel twice, you know. I mean, I read my own novel hundreds and hundreds of times, so I build all kinds of things into it. And you want the reader who reads the book one time to get as much out of it as they can. So rather perversely, I'm sort of trying to work against my page-turning quality slightly and just slow things down. I'm not sure how successful I'm being at that. But in terms of being literary, I've always thought of myself in that bracket. I mean, it's simply because I'm trying to use language in an original way. I'm trying to push the fiction into areas it might not have been before. You know, you're trying to do something new, and it's really difficult. I mean, it's almost impossible. But part of that is to do with the voice that you have and the voice that you develop. And despite the fact I think of all my books being rather different, at least, you know, in terms of when you first look at them in a very superficial way, I think that there's a voice that runs through all of them somehow, and you can sort of recognize that the voice is as mine. So, the literary side of things is important, but it does, as you say, you know, it does get muddied slightly by people trying to put me in one genre or another.
Well, speaking of the voice, one thing that was actually kind of a pleasure to read, I felt that the protagonist's voice, your voice, kind of sort of came through. There was a lot of, as to the so-and-so, you know, when he was describing the things. I noticed that. A lot of sort of, you know, kind of repetitive phrases and things like that that really kind of helps to get the reader on course.
It was a very hard thing to write him because, obviously, I'm writing him in the first person.
Yeah.
And he, you know, obviously he's not me. He's the problem with writing Thomas Parry in Divided Kingdom was that, in a way, he's not a real person. I mean, he's a kind of construct, because, you know, here's a man who, as an 8-year-old boy, was taken away from his parents and placed in a new family, given a new name, a new upbringing, and a completely different identity, and an artificial identity, you know. And so, you really, what the voice that you're listening to is that of an artificial being, a kind of non-entity, trying to find who he was, you know, trying to find almost something human in his background, and trying to find out the human being that he was. So it was actually really, really difficult voice to do, and at certain points, you know, certain drafts, I found him getting terribly cold and getting terribly abstract, and I had to make sure that despite him being artificial, he was somehow, you know, he was somehow human. The warmth that would have been there originally kind of bled through. But it was difficult. I mean, it took a lot of work to get that voice right.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, the book, you know, selling the illusion hinges entirely upon that voice.
Mm.
And the thing,
he's your guide. Yeah, he's your guide.
Yeah.
To it. I mean,
yeah. I mean, it's such a the thing. I was reading this, and I couldn't put it down either. But at first, I was sort of like, this is utterly preposterous. But as he's telling the story, I'm like believing it more and more and more.
Well, it is preposterous. It is preposterous, especially when if you describe it in two or three sentences to someone, they'll say that couldn't happen. You know, I just don't believe that, and you're going to have to convince me. And of course, what I try and do in the book is convince the reader. leader and persuade them into the reality of that situation. But also, I mean, I often think that this book was really inspired, or really where it comes from, is the time I spent in Berlin in the early 80s, before the wall came down, you know, and I found myself living in this divided city. And it seemed to me at the time, well, it was, on the one hand, it was very exciting, but at the same time, it was utterly artificial. And I thought I would sometimes just pinch myself to make sure it was real, because I would look around and think, how can people actually live this way? I mean, how have they allowed this to happen? This wall to be built down the middle of their city, you know, how have they allowed themselves to be separated from their loved ones in this way? And yet it was a reality, it happened, you know. And so I think those kind of ideas interest me, because you may have something, you know, you have a world that's, you have a parallel world, if you like, an artificial reality, but it's shot through by very real human emotions. I mean, Divided Kingdom is full of emotion, I hope anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's shot through with feelings of love and loss and grief and all those things. In fact, I think that's the way in which it becomes believable, because if the reader gets involved in that, in the book at all, it's through those emotions and through identifying with those. So, you know, at the core, the book is very human indeed, but it spans a big, it's got a big span to it, you know, right from the artificial idea in the first place, right down to the very human emotion that the characters have as they're going through it.
My phone is inexplicably dying. I thought it was fully charged, but I will try to ask you a few questions before it dies. But first off, there have been a lot of comparisons between this book and Orwell, and saying that this is the best dystopian novel since 1984. Was Orwell much of a presence when you were actually writing this book? Or
Not at all, actually. And at the same time, as I was writing it, I had a kind of wry smile on my face, because I thought, oh, I know what they're going to say. You know, they're going to mention Orwell. They're probably going to mention Huxley, Brave New World, and they're probably going to mention, they might mention, I don't know, Margaret Atwood, The Handmaid's Tale. And I was supposed to be imagining.
You
can't help but imagine the critics. But funnily enough, because I didn't approach the novel in that way. You see, I didn't start off thinking I'm writing a dystopian novel or something. I started off with this, as I described right at the beginning of this, you know, a very sort of quirky, simple, kind of fairly inauspicious idea, you know, or even thought. And I didn't know where it was going to lead me.
What about...
The second thing is, if I could just say it,
it's just
that it's, of course, not futuristic at all, you know. I mean, Orwell wrote 1984 in 1948.
Yeah.
So he was setting the book 40 years or whatever ahead of when he was writing, and this book to me, I mean, Divided Kingdom to me is very much a kind of alternative present. It's not the future at all. And if you look at it carefully, you'll see there are mobile phones and there are computers very much as we have them now, except that certain societies have distilled what we have, or removed it, or advanced it. But it's very much an alternative present, and so I'm not really kind of making predictions or prophecies. I'm just simply trying to unveil. Yeah, I'm trying to sort of say, well, what if something had happened 25 years ago, and what if the present was completely different? How could it, you know, how would it be? What would things look like? How would people be living? So, you know, it's speculative, but it's not futuristic.
Well, it also reminded me very much of Anthony Burgess's The Wanting Seed, in the sense that it's also a similarly kind of absurd idea that is convincing, but at the same time, there are elements of humor throughout, you know? Was that an influence for you, or...?
I don't know that book at all. I've read a bit of Anthony Burgess, but not for a long time. And I read Clockwork Orange, obviously, I suppose. And I read the Enderby novels, the novels about the poet. But the one you mentioned, though, I don't know that one.
You should check it out. It's basically this world in which there's an overpopulation problem, and then basically they do two things. One, they encourage homosexuality. Two, they encourage cannibalism. So it kind of reminded me. It's interesting. Well, speaking of influences, what are some of your literary influences?
Well, I mean, to bring the last two questions together, I mean, I think a book, you know, to me, Divided Kingdom bears much more relation to a book like The Master and Margarita, which is Mikhail Bulgakov. I don't know whether you know that novel.
Yes.
But that's like a Russian novel from the I think it was written in the 30s, written under Stalin. And that novel has all those elements in it. It's a satire, it's a piece of surrealism, it's almost got a thriller element, and it's absurd as well in the way that you're calling my idea absurd. I mean, you know,
in a good way, though.
The devil arrived in Moscow in the guise of a black cat. I mean, that's pretty bizarre. And yet that book, you know, he makes it work. There's an amazing humor running through that book as well. So that, to me, is just one of the great books. And you know, it tends to be books rather than writers. I mean, so the other books for me that are influences, and I suppose when you say influences, what I really mean is books I wish I'd written. Would be, I mentioned Marquez earlier, but The 100 Years of Solitude would be one. The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Murakami.
Mm-hmm.
And what else? Toni Morrison, actually, The Song of Solomon is a book I go back to. Gunter Grass, The Tin Drum. And then quite a lot of American things. I mean, almost anything Flannery O'Connor wrote. You know, I mean, I sort of think of her as my literary godmother or something. And William Faulkner as well. I mean, and books like As I Lay Dying are books that often are on my writing table when I'm writing, and I kind of will open them and look at them. And you're not reading the book exactly for what it is. You're just kind of trying to remind yourself of what's possible or what's good.
Okay. Well, I don't want the phone to die, so Rupert, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Ed.
And,
Alright, you worthless baguettes! Listen up! You know there's only two things that come from libraries: germs and bookworms! Well, which one are you? Alright, at ease. This is Sergeant Champion! And if you think you've got what it takes to read the 5 LBC nominees, well, you got another thing coming! Oh! Private Esposito! Wipe that shit-ass smirk right off your face, boy! Drop down and give me 20 pages! 20 pages of Albin, son! All right, privates. This week's nominee is Edward Falco's Sabbath Night in the Church of the Verana. This is one manly collection of short stories. And if you don't feel the testosterone while reading this book, well, then you can just get your sweet mama's ass right out of my car. You hear me? Oh, Private Esposito, you got something to contribute, son? All right, then. While this platoon runs 6 miles, we'll get some introductory discussion going. All right, privates, you know the plan, so hut, 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 hut.
It doesn't matter what I say.
So, I am here with Scott Esposito, and I'm actually here with him in person, unlike the other 4 nominees, in large part because, well, he kind of actually lives close by to me. But, Scott, how are you doing?
It's true, I live in the Bay Area,
yes.
Just like you. I'm doing pretty good, you know, we're drinking.
So we are drinking, actually.
In honor of Mr. Falco and his
manliness.
Yeah. Narratives.
Well, okay, so let's get right down to it. What was it about Sabbath Night that sort of made this the LBC nominee of choice?
All right, well, you know, I mean, my post is up there.
Yeah.
And that pretty much says it all. You know, the man can tell a story. You know, he's got some real storytelling skills. And just the way that the multiple strands of the narratives were handled, the way they were kind of brought together to resonate in different ways, I thought that was really skillful. I mean, you know, his language is pretty bare, pretty stripped down, and you know, he has his own style, which is interesting, but just the manipulation of the elements, you know, that really caught me. It seemed like every story had something going for it in that vein, and you know, it just tells a story.
Okay. So basically, it boils down for you to storytelling in the end, or?
Well, you could say that, Ed. But yeah, I mean, well, other things too. I mean, I found the characters interesting. I thought he was pretty deft, getting a lot out there really quickly, and you know, just kind of painting a scene and tossing you right into it. Well, when I interviewed him, you know, we definitely talked about that a little bit, and that was one of his big things. Mm-hmm. He likes stories that put you in the thick of it right to begin with, and that's what his stories do. And I mean, you know, Wolf Point too, which is his novel,
yeah,
which just released in 2005. That too, I read that in a day or two, and you know, from the first page, hooked. It definitely has a strong opening, and you know, that characterizes all his work.
Gotcha. Well, what about the last question here? What about manliness?
Manliness.
Yeah. Was it the manliness, the vigor, the brio, the masculinity? I mean, what about this? Was this just sort of like, you know, did you kind of like read Sabbath Night going, oh, whoa, you know? I did personally, Scott.
I
don't know.
I like to sit around my underwear and, you know, and kind of eat food off my chest as I read the book. So
eat soup, soup.
Well,
eat soup?
Food.
Soup.
Well, that would be painful.
I didn't. Okay, yeah, that would be.
Unless I had a very thick
second
bowl.
Degree burns, man. Okay.
Well, no. I mean, that's worth touching on. yeah, you know, the guy does kind of deal with these aspects, domestication versus kind of being out there in the world, and you know, a lot of the narratives, like they kind of draw their narrative strand from just this conflict between the two realms. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, to a certain extent, it's kind of a masculine thing. You see how that applies to men, and you know, there are women, and you know, they're kind of playing the role of as leading the man out of the domesticity in a lot of these stories. So yeah, but I think that he finds a lot to do with that. You know, that narrative does pop up a lot in his stories, and it is kind of like a similar thing throughout, but I think he still does a lot with it. So it's not just like, you know, the same thing back to back, which would be kind of dull.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I was gonna mention something about eating raw meat, but I don't know. It's sort of like maybe go to the whole Jack London sort of thing.
Well, only if you're eating sushi, and that can be a very feminine thing.
I had sushi today, and
I
felt very manly about
it. Sorry, don't put that on.
That's terrible. Scott Esposito, thank you so much.
Sorry, I gotta do something.
Oh, man.
Until there's nothing left at all.
Okay, I am talking with Edward Falco, who is the author of the LBC nominee, Sabbath Night in the Church of the Piranha, which is a bit of a mouthful, but a very good title nonetheless. One thing I wanted to ask you, Ed, first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's a quiet Saturday morning. I'm doing a little work. Things are good.
Okay, good. Well, one thing that strikes me about the stories in this collection is the way that you take these sort of rural, sort of seemingly uninvolving maloons, the kinds of things that, you know, Richard Ford, John Updike, but yet you add this definitive grit to them. And I'm wondering, it's a very interesting juxtaposition. What steps do you take to kind of keep things alive like this?
Well, I'm going to try. I kind of missed the beginning of the question. Interesting, what did you say?
Oh, a juxtaposition between sort of a kind of John Updike, you know, typical sort of, you know, middle-aged couples who are having affairs. But with you, I think there's a certain kind of grit that is involved with it. And I'm wondering what steps you take as a writer to ensure that that grit is there, that the stories are actually alive.
Okay, yeah, sure, I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
You know, I'm interested in characters who have edges to them, characters who are wrestling with something or troubled by something. And in that sense, I suppose I'm no different than John Updike or any other writer. But my characters often come from working class kinds of backgrounds that may not be as polished as a typical Updike character. And also maybe more likely to be in a sort of set of circumstances might be foreign to the upper middle classes.
Yeah. Well, there's a very sort of John Cheever, Erskine, Caldwell kind of quality to your stories that I got. Sort of a classical sense of plotting mixed with that sort of unusual human element.
Yeah, well, again, sometimes I'm amazed at how people think my characters are so far from the ordinary. It's kind of surprising because they don't seem all that far from the ordinary to me. I like to think I'm just willing to say things about characters that might be more disturbing than a more conventional, a more conventional writer might be willing to deal with. But my characters seem pretty normal. They think a lot about sex.
Yeah. Certainly kept me reading.
Excuse me?
Certainly kept me reading.
Yeah. So there's sex and death, big subjects. I try to think about those things honestly and frankly, and so my characters, I think, may be a little rougher edged than some others.
But I guess that's kind of, you know, what you're saying is kind of what I was wanting to get into, the idea that that we don't seem to think that there are perverse and strange things in everyday sort of people.
Right.
Why do you think that there's this stigma in fiction, like, you know, to sort of be kind of safe and mainstream and deal with, like, oh my God, I missed last month's rent or something benign like that, you know, as opposed to, you know what, I may not find the love of my life or, you know. Yeah.
That permeates everything we do in our life and social manners and appropriate behavior. And you know, when I do readings, sometimes I have a very hard time reading my stories aloud, because I'm in a sort of social circumstance where I'm very wary about, you know, offending somebody or bruising somebody's sensibilities or talking about things that you just don't talk about in a social context. And yet, when I'm working on the page, when I'm working with a story, I feel free to say absolutely anything as long as it rings true to me. I feel free to say anything about a character if it seems to be true about that character, without any sense of concern for who might be offended or who might be shocked by it, because I know a reader can always put the story down. A reader can always say, "Well, this guy is not writing the kinds of stories that I'm really interested in." So there's a kind of privilege, I think, in the written word, and in writing stories that the readers have the choice of reading or not reading, that may not extend to other forms, other media like television or radio or public readings. Anyway, on the page, I just feel free to say whatever, as long as it seems pertinent and true to the story and to the moment.
It's almost like you're in a catch-22, because on one hand, if you go for shock value, explicitly, then it's going to be, oh, well, this is just a sort of a stunt, a sort of Michel Houellebecq kind of situation. But on the other hand, if you, you know, go straight with what the gut is feeling, there are the sort of prim and proper and prudish type of readers, or listeners in this case, who may not sort of, you know, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me very interesting that in certain literary circles, you know, the whole idea of, like, you know, the perverse as a kind of strange thing, that it's going to upset someone if the cover button is off by 2 inches or something.
Right, right, yeah. There's also, you know, a sense of any character that's not what's considered ordinary is gothic or is in some way bizarre. I have a character in one of my stories that I like a lot, and it's one of my favorite stories, called Tulsa Snow, in which there's a woman who picks up a guy at an airport, and then they go back to a motel room. So now, if you're willing to buy that kind of thing may happen in this life, then I think it's only fair to sort of follow the behavior and see what those characters are about and why that behavior, why the behavior should be of interest to anybody. And that woman character, once they're in the motel room together, takes her teeth out. She has false teeth, and it's so shocking to the male character that he can hardly look at her. Now that's pretty weird and pretty bizarre behavior. But in fact, I knew a woman, a poet, who had been who was raised with she didn't have much money when she was growing up, and her teeth were all crooked, and there were double rows of them. She had them replaced. I often thought about that. She's an attractive woman, and that kind of played on my imagination. What would that be like to sort of have one sort of idea of what a person was like, and then have something so shocking come to change and alter your opinion or alter your sense of what they looked like? And that, of course, got me into thinking about surface versus depth. You know, what we who we are, what we look like on the surface, what we are underneath the surface, which is one of the things I'm almost always interested in my stories.
But at the same time, also, Ed, that Tulsa Snow story also kind of comments, I suppose, why do we attach a kind of sort of perverse or ugly or unattractive label on things that are inherently human? Look, you know, why are we so, you know, like people fart, people burp, people go to the bathroom, and yet these things here in America are, you know.
Right, it's decorum.
Yes.
And probably in public we don't want people to do those things.
Yes.
But in fiction, when they're relevant, when they work, they belong. So my characters are willing to do those kinds of things, and I don't really try to be intentionally shocking ever. I just try to be true to the characters and to what would happen in a given situation. Now sometimes the situations are a bit extreme, but that's what makes the dramatic. The ordinary can be dramatic, but often it's the extreme that's dramatic.
Well, since we're talking about decorum and we're talking about what literary fiction, at least in the eyes of others, should be or shouldn't be, I wanted to focus on the concern for, in these stories, with manhood and fatherhood, particularly with the professor's son. What do you say to a critic who says the contemporary fiction has too many, you know, predominantly white males and manhood and fatherhood and really, Ed, you should be writing about, like, you know, people of multiculturalism, etc. To what extent does your own fiction kind of combat that perception or respond to it?
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's a definite need for a variety of voices, and I think the culture has been changing in very good ways in the last 30 years or so to try to open up our world to different kinds of voices, and that's only to be applauded. That's a very good thing. As for me, I can't write what I don't know.
Yeah.
I can only write out of. I get one life to live. I don't, you know, I don't get to like come back the next time and try to write some out of some different perspective. So I write about my life, and I write about what comes out of my life, and that's the only option I have. If I'm telling stories that are worth listening to, I hope those stories will find an audience. The themes of fiction remain fairly universal, so I don't think there's it's not as if we're asking for people to address different concerns. We're just looking for a wider range of voices in writing, and I have nothing, you know, I have no problem with that whatsoever. But as for me, I can only write out of my own experience.
Well, there's also, for example, your experience. I mean, you know, just to give you a sense of what's different for me, the story Sweet and The Revenant both deal with, I think, they're concerned very much with the sexual guilt, the struggle to kind of remain alive despite this. And I know that you also grew up with a Catholic background. Now, I didn't grow up with a Catholic background, but I can look at these stories and say, oh, well, this is an interesting sort of different perspective. But I also wanted to ask how much of your Catholic background has kind of an influence upon your fiction?
Yeah, well, I think of it as a nurturing, environmental kind of influence. I mean, I grew up in a religious family. I was an old boy when I was a kid, and so that all has influence on the way I see the world, the way I think about the world, and it works its way into my fiction. I mean, I rejected any kind of traditional religion a very long time ago, but that doesn't mean I don't continually think about it. I don't continually think about the spiritual and the role the spiritual needs to play in life and how material culture and this culture moves us further and further away from spiritual roots. All of those things are of interest and are issues to me, and I think about them a lot in fiction. A story like Acid is a sort of looks at somebody who's fallen traditionally into a Catholic role. He goes to church every morning. He takes communion every morning. But I think the point of the story is that this is a character who needs ritual and who needs meaning in his life, and who finds it through Catholicism. So that's fine. But I don't think the story says that Catholicism is the only way to find ritual and meaning in life. Basically, I'm interested in how we get in touch with the deeper parts of ourselves, our lives, and that, me is a kind of spiritual thinking.
Well, I was particularly blown away by The Revenant, and
one of my favorite stories too.
Yes, which also won the push card. I found out later. I was really hooked into that. But I guess more than any of the other stories in this collection, it suggested to me the motif that you're concerned with. That irrespective of age, we really still don't completely know who we are at times. It's very much like that passage in Philip Roth's American Pastoral that what we know, you know, that's how we know we're alive, we're wrong, etc. Now, why do you think you're so concerned with this question?
Well, I think that's one of the kinds of questions you need to ask yourself if you want to live a decent life, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you want,
sure.
I mean, if you, it seems to me essential to lead a meaningful to leading a meaningful life, to sort of understand why you do the things you do and who you are. That just seems like an essential question, one of the questions that literature can explore and literature can answer. In The Revenant, I think, you know, what I was shooting for at the end there was a sense of that, a very spiritual sense of the interconnectedness of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know who he is. You're right. I mean, he sort of has gone through his life on with blinders on.
It's certainly an extreme case, yeah.
Yeah, and not too, but not a rare thing when you're dealing with the kind of trauma he dealt with as a young man. I mean, you'll hear people talking about World War II. These guys in their 80s and late 80s, who in once they're asked to talk about it will start crying.
Yeah.
You know, things happened to them 50 years ago. But in order to go through every day, they just won't think about it, won't talk about it. All my uncles fought in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And you could not get a word out of any of them about what happened to them there. And I knew that they had seen intense combat where they were. So I think sometimes in order to deal with stuff, you have to ignore it. But there's a huge price to be paid for that, which is what's happening to that character in The Revenant. But in the end, I think I hope he comes to a moment where he understands that the interconnectedness between everything and why that pain is there. You know, why that pain he's been running from, where it comes from, and why it's there.
But I think also, though, you know, the thing that really made that story, I think, speak to me and others is that, you know, he does actually make an initial step to break out of his routine. And the fascinating thing about reading that story is to sort of see the kind of gradual steps he takes to get to that particular place of knowing himself, of confronting these particular issues, etc.
Yeah, it's kind of brought on to him by things that are out of his control. He takes his daughter to a concert.
Yeah.
And there's the loud noise and the violence
and the flashing,
crazy
and
vision that he has that just sort of clicks for him and makes him is a catalyst to bringing all the stuff that had been buried back up to the surface again and forcing him to deal with it. A lot of that stuff is just I think just happens to him.
Your stories are very sort of plotted and structured.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they work sort of in tandem towards answering the question that we're talking about. Do you think that much of the contemporary literature landscape is too concerned with postmodernism or too many stylistic tricks that kind of don't detract away from sort of this visceral thrust? Or?
I think we've kind of moved away from that. I mean, certainly in the 80s and early 90s, where there was an awful lot of emphasis on postmodernistic, metafictional kinds of writing, innovative kinds of writing, and a lot of good work came out of that. Barth and Bartholomew and Coover, some terrific work came out of that. The Artist is the Babysitter is one of my favorite stories by Coover. But I think we've moved back toward a more traditional kind of fiction in the last 10-15 years or so, and I think most of the books I'm seeing are basically traditional storytelling. Though there's, you know, I think there needs to be room for everything out there. And if it's, if you like David Foster Wallace, I'm not one of his big fans, but if you like him, I can certainly understand what it is you see in him that you like.
Well, I also should point out that you're not entirely, you also do experimental fiction yourself.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, hypertext fiction.
Right.
I was wondering if you could compare the two modes of writing.
They're very different. Yeah, you know, one is, you know, I, I'm kind of simplistic about this, and it drives some people crazy, but I think of a kind of a word that's out of fashion these days, and that's I think of some writing as experimental,
yeah,
and some writing as traditional. And it's a fairly easy divide for me. I know what the structure of a traditional narrative is, and I know when I'm trying to work in that vein to tell a story that has a particular problem and develops through complications, and I follow it through. And I love it. I mean, for a while I'm in the university environment. For a while, that was so out of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
that was so passé to want to write like that. But a good writer, I think, does what he loves. I don't know why else you would write. And I've always loved the traditional story, and so I've always worked in the traditional story. But I've also been interested in for me, what is simply writing that diverges from that and that tries to find new ways of making meaning, that tries to put language and story and narrative together in ways that go against the grain of traditional narrative. And I enjoy doing that too. So for me, it's about what I love doing, what I enjoy doing. I mean, there's nobody in my study with me when I'm writing,
yeah.
And I'm not getting paid a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
So I do what I love to do, and I'm working at the moment on a piece of digital writing with a friend, a photographer, Mary Pinto. She's working on some very interesting photographs, and I'm trying to do some digital writing, and I'm playing with Flash, and I'm having fun doing that. At the same time, I've got a short story going. So for me, they're not different. They're not different. Essentially, it's all writing, and I have so many compulsions, so many things that I need to write about that I need different ways of expressing. Also,
well, the other thing too, it's that if you want to get into a form versus function argument, look at Gilbert Sorrentino's work.
Sure.
There's a lot of visceral human moments in there, despite the fact that it's an extremely fragmented Terry form at times.
Right, or Carol Maso.
Yeah.
There are lots of good writers out there who just really steer away completely from the tradition. And I think you can sense a good writer when you're reading one. Lance Olson's, I saw him mentioned on the Lip blog recently. He's an interesting writer. There's lots of good writers out there doing the kinds of writing that would have to be called anything other than, that are certainly not traditional kinds of writing.
It seems to me, though, that going back to what we were talking about earlier about decorum, it's almost a decorum not just in tone, but also in style, and that, you can't write experimental fiction. Do you find the stylistics to be a restriction in your writing at all, or the sort of the emphasis on traditionalism?
No, I don't find that to be a, I don't find, let me put it this way, what other people want or expect of me is not an issue. and again, it's not an issue because I'm not getting, I'm not working for somebody else.
Yeah.
I have my own kinds of dreams and desires and wants from writing, and I'll go about doing that whatever feels right for me, in whatever way feels right for me. So I love stylists. Ray Carver is, I think, as a stylist, both a traditional writer and a brilliant stylist. And Bartholomew and Coover, I think good writers are always good stylists.
To what extent...
I think they go together.
Huh. To what extent would you say that you are a literary writer?
Well, completely.
Okay.
I would say that... I guess it's according to how you make the distinction. A commercial writer, and I don't mean this in any kind of a negative way, but a commercial writer has to be concerned with commerce.
Mm-hmm.
With what's going, who the audience is for the work, whether the audience is going to be interested in what she writes or he writes, and has to produce work with commerce in mind. A literary writer, I think of as somebody who produces writing with other goals, with more not commercial goals in mind. I mean, if I were a commercial writer, why in God's name would I write digital work or hypertext? There's no market. There's nothing for it. I do it because I love writing, and the experimentation of it is exciting to me, and with no eye whatsoever to the commercial. Now, literary, I mean, I think when you have books like a press like Unbridled is publishing, it gets a little trickier. Unbridled, I think, publishes literary fiction, but also seeks to market it to as wide an audience as possible. And so then there's a kind of borderline. You know, you're concerned about audience, but you also want to be concerned principally with the kind of writing that you're doing. So the experimental is maybe the extreme other side, no concern for commerce. And the literary press like Unbridled might be someplace more toward the middle.
I see. So I was going to ask you about the whole sort of the commercial issues of even like a small independent press, like either Unbridled or Soft Skull or Coffee House.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess it's tricky. Have you experienced sort of like, you know, tricky waters with regards to, you know, hey, Ed, maybe you might want to hone this, not as an editorial decision, but because we are marketing towards a literary audience and we need you to sort of, we need you to modify things so that we could market better for that particular literary audience, that niche.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of, that's not necessarily a bad thing when you have somebody like Greg Michelson or Fred Ramey at Unbridled thinking about audience for you and thinking about, you know, where am I going to place this book? How are you going to sell copies? Because somebody needs to think about that. My novel, Wolf Point, I never thought of that book as a mystery or a thriller, and yet Unbridled has been marketing it as a literary thriller is what they're calling it. Now, for me, that's entirely a marketing decision, and it's been a good one. It's picked up reviews that it wouldn't have got, and it's picked up sales that it wouldn't have got because they found a kind of way to market it. So I'm grateful for them for doing that. It doesn't change what the book is for me, which is a kind of very tense, very suspenseful exploration of sexuality and material and many other things. But it is a suspenseful book, and they found a way to market it, and I'm happy for them for having done that.
Gotcha. One final question. You mentioned in an interview with the Blue Penny Quarterly that you wrote both this story collection and Wolf Point initially in longhand, and that you only have just started becoming comfortable with the computer. Do you think that despite the level of comfort you're feeling both in this experimental fiction that you are talking about, and also whatever, I guess, for lack of a better word, narrative, more narrative fiction, has this shifted the emphasis in the way that you write your fiction in any way?
Yeah, that Blue Penny interview is actually really old.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
And I haven't written in longhand since the first personal computers came on the market. But before personal computers, what was that, 1990? Something, 92? Something like that?
Sounds right.
That's about right, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Before that, I was writing longhand and then translating it onto the computer. But we were going back 15 years or something.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was a big change. I would write out, it was a weird process. I would write longhand, but ideas get going pretty quickly, pretty fluidly, and I would write in a kind of longhand that was someplace between longhand and code, because I'd have to read it the next day, or else even I couldn't make out what it said. So I'd have to read it really quickly, or else I'd forget. And then I'd translate it to the computer. And eventually, when computers became more easily and readily available, I just started writing always on the computer. And that led to huge changes, yeah, in the way I write. I write faster. I get more writing. I get more writing done. And I don't miss writing by longhand at all. Though I know poets and friends who argue that there's a physical sort of process that they won't give up. But for me, it's thought, you know, and I can type a lot faster on the computer, and so it's more harmonious for me.
There's more aches in the hands than longhand.
Yeah. I can't imagine writing longhand anymore. I mean, I just can't imagine it.
We're truly spoiled, huh?
It's really slow. And I don't miss whiteout at all.
Oh, yeah. Well, Ed, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.